Food Talk with Michael Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, Mike Colomeco here. You're listening to Food Talk, and we're starting this conversation with hangovers. Yeah, back to hangovers. That's where we're stuck with this today, right? I mean, that was a conversation before the microphone. Who was it? Erin was saying she can't... you're listening to Food Talk, by the way, on Heritage Radio Network. I know this is a strange segue into a... But why not? I mean, the stuff we say off mic is better than the stuff we say on mic. So we're just... Doesn't have to be that way, and we don't have the FCC here. Yeah, so Erin was talking about being hungover. Erin Fairbanks, Heritage Radio. She's one of the she's my boss, I guess, is what you can call it. Crack that whip. Yeah. But she was talking about being hungover and drinking less, and then we said, that's your problem. The deal with hangovers is the more you drink, the less you get hungover. That, would you guys agree with me?
Absolutely correct.
I mean, you develop that iron gut. Your liver just goes, oh, shit, here we go again. Yeah. It's another day, and he's going to do it. And then you just build up those resources. Jess?
I definitely punished my liver last night, so...
What was the story? Give us a day in the life of Chaz.
Well,
Jeff, by the way, Chaz is the chef owner of Soul Chicken, Clinton Street, an amazing new wing spot. And my favorite thing on your menu is the cauliflower, which is crazy.
The cauliflower is good. It's crispy. I got one of my guys in here who's very, very vital doing that, Rob Finn. He's just hanging out in the back. He's watching me be all hungover.
So what did you do last night that got you hungover?
So we had the guys come in from Vice, and I guess they came in.
Oh, they were filming?
No, they were just hanging out, and they just came in, and they were just like, oh, yeah, more shots of Yamazaki. Yeah, you need one, you need one, you need one, you need one. And I had about six or seven shots of these guys, and you know, they paid for all of them, which was great. But I'm paying for it now.
Got to drink more, Chaz.
I got to drink more.
Simply put. All right, Chaz is my second guest, but he's not right now. My first guest today is Chris Jackal. Brother, how are you?
I'm well, yourself?
Good, good. So those of you that don't, tell us, I mean, I got a bio here, but I know you. When did I bump into you first?
At I-Fury.
I-Fury or before that?
I think I-Fury was the first time we ran into each other.
Mm-hmm. And you were with Mike White. You were with Mike White for how many years?
I was with Michael for just over a year, about 14 months.
Not at Maria.
So okay. I did like the first couple of months of the transition through the company, checking out the restaurant, seeing where it was. Jared Gadbaugh, the chef at Maria, and I worked at 11 Essen Park together. So he introduced us to Michael. So Michael and I spent about 6 months getting to know each other. And then I-Fury happened, and there we were.
I-Fury was, I mean.
It was a special one, man.
Special one, man. And I'll tell you what, I had my doubts. Location, second floor, in a hotel. I mean, I'm checking off boxes on the wrong side of the list.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And a humongous space.
Humongous. I mean 14,000 square feet.
I walked into that dining. You ever been?
No, I haven't been.
Chaz? Oh, so you it's in the, and that was called the Langham. When it opened up, it was a different name. It was some Italian
Satai.
Company. Satai mm-hmm. Hotel. I mean, you enter off of 5th Avenue, just north of 34th Street, and then you got to go. It's like a lobby of a hotel, and you got to go upstairs, and it's like in New York, that's like, New Yorkers don't like that.
Nope. No signage.
And the room was ginormous.
Yeah. Filling that room was very difficult at the beginning.
But the review, three stars.
Yeah, three stars. Front page, New York Times, man. Not a lot of people get that.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful one.
Yeah. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So tell me about, I get all these PR email things that mostly, like, I'm sure like most of us, you wake up in the morning and log on to your various email accounts, and the first thing you do is delete. And then you get to like the three or four that you want to read that matter to you.
Yep.
And I mean, this time of year too, they're like, because it's Christmas, you should see the shits in my inbox. Like, people are just pitching you the lamest stuff.
You know, they have an unsubscribe button on the bottom of most emails.
I never read. I guess I'm not so techno savvy. I just do the delete thing, which takes about 20 minutes. But I didn't delete your thing. So you opened up. Tell me about this new project. We'll talk about Alanda in a minute because that's kind of like where you are. Yep. Tell me about this other thing and what it is and what brought you
to it. Sure. So it's called Uma Tamaqueria. What does that mean?
What's Tamaqueria?
Tamaqueria is a slang term in Brazil for restaurants based on the tamaki, which is the Japanese hand roll. It's essentially sushi in a cone shape.
Yes.
You know, that's really all it is. You know, I had been building this business plan for a long time, and it was basically sort of a way to – offer accessibility to what is normally a high-end, expensive product. You know, you either eat shitty sushi from a deli container or some I don't know. Am I allowed to be inappropriate on the show? I guess I am, right?
Yeah, sure. Sure. You know, hell, I'm the fucking host. I mean, the poster boy of inappropriate.
Like bad Chinese sushi, or like you spend $200 and correct. You spend 2 hours eating something high end.
Hard to find the middle.
Yeah. Virtually impossible to find the middle. So I really spent a long time thinking about what we could do to sort of accomplish that. And I'm very passionate about rice. I'm very passionate about Japanese food. We'll get into Alonda on that and how I'm bringing that into Italian food in another sense.
Because that would have been the logical segue, but I'm going right for the
yeah, of course. So, well, let's. One's sort of, truthfully, people are more interested in Uma than Alonda in a lot of ways because they see the business side of it and the accessibility side of it, which is the biggest one, is the accessibility side of it.
East Village.
Chelsea, no. Almost.
Okay.
So it's 14th and 7th. It's northwest corner, 14th and 7th.
You're on 14th.
On 7th Avenue, okay. We are like 50 feet from 14th Street on 7th Avenue. So it's what it is it's a made-to-order concept. So it's an assembly line. You walk up and you choose a protein, you choose a sauce, you choose a vegetable. The tamaki is made in front of you and handed you over the counter. We have a couple of things called tamaki sets, which are two tamaki and a side salad or a soup in the winter. Three tamaki, you know, priced at $13 and $18.
Are the proteins all fish?
All fish, okay. Except for tofu. We do
a nod to the vegan vegetarian rolls.
Yeah, we gotta make it happen. We have a vegetarian roll also. So no, it's completely pescatarian in the restaurant. We make the rice in house. We cook it in the morning. We season it in a hunkiri. I mean, we use a Japanese wooden shimoji. We make a mix of sugar and salt and several different vinegars. We really do it right.
Right, you're not playing.
No, it's tasty food, man. I'm really proud of it, and I think people are really starting to understand it. And again, the key is that we really offer. I mean, you can't find this for $6 anywhere.
That's what they are per roll.
$6.
$6.
Mm-hmm.
And they're nice size.
I mean, the weight is what you buy a maki in Whole Foods or in your grocery. We did a lot of research in regards to it. The quantity of rice is approximately the same. The quantity of protein is approximately the same.
Who the hell eats that shit at Whole Foods? That
I do, man.
Do you use it decent?
Like, I'm not even ashamed of it. Like, I have my moments where I'm like, I want something
hungry and healthy, and that's it.
And the thing is, I know how awful it is. That's what really sold me on this concept.
That's what I was going to get at, because, I mean,
I know how terrible that is. Like, I made rice in Morimoto every day for 2 years. Like, we ground the rice. It came in brown husked. We grind the rice in Morimoto every morning. The rice is special, regardless of what you want to say about the restaurant.
No, and Morimoto's a badass.
Yeah,
Steven Starr, Morimoto, whatever.
Machine.
He's a dude. I've seen that guy with a knife. I've seen him do some demos. He's it.
Yes.
He is the shit.
The real deal is a word for
that. He's the real deal.
Absolutely. So, like, and I, as a consumer, eat this shit, you know? And I'm sort of like, and I have no other option for it. So how did we come up with something that, A, could travel? The cone shape is an obvious call, burrito or taco or all these sort of things. You can walk on the street and eat it as you move. The tamaki is also this. And how do you provide something that's of a quality level? And you know, we worked it out through the health department. We can keep the rice at room temperature, so it's never been refrigerated, which is a major key factor to it. We make it a couple of times a day. It's really...
But your workers have to wear freaking gloves, right?
Yeah, but they don't use their hands for the rice.
Yeah, it's not like, because I know all the sushi places get dinged by the health department for not wearing gloves.
Yeah.
You cannot cut raw fish wearing gloves.
The beauty
you just can't
of this
do it,
is no. I have college kids making these things. I don't have skilled labor doing this work.
Right.
That's the beauty of this, is the only skilled labor I have are the people making the rice in the mornings, people making the rice in the afternoon, and the person cutting the fish. That's it.
Where's the fish coming from? Local and imported?
Local and imported. We did the best we could.
Because your price point's low. I mean, you can flying in from
Sushi Market. So we have, So we have tuna from the Philippines, sustainably caught. It's still line caught. It is gassed, it's frozen, but it's line caught. We have blue swimmer cream crabs from Thailand, which is sustainable in the sense that they only remove enough crabs from their farm as they replace. So we did some research in regards to what we could do. Fluke is Long Island.
Mm.
We do one seasonal special, which is a local fish. At the moment is Fluke. It's winter season. Fluke is a winter fish. So we do that where we can. But again, it's a price point limitation. So we did a ton of research. We tasted a ton of products. I mean, I must have eaten 25 different crab meats before I could find one that was either frozen or pasteurized or fresh or whatever that hit the price point, hit the quality level. We actually mix it between three different portions of this crab meat. We get back meat, we get claw meat, and we mix it to like these three different versions of it. We mix them in ourselves so we get the consistency that I want and the flavor profile that I want. It was really, we spent a long time like developing it. I'm really proud of it. The operation works and it tastes good and it's reasonably priced.
How many seats?
15.
Mostly takeout. So it's, you're geared for people to wind up, bang, walk on the
walk
street,
in,
which is the idea of the shape.
Lunch.
It's like an ice cream cone.
Exactly.
Pick it up and eat it from the top down. It's sealed at the bottom.
You're on the go. You're New York City. It's right above the subway stop.
Yeah, it's
right on the corner of 14th and 7th. You come out of the subway. I'm on the go. I'm in a hurry.
Yeah.
Like, grab
NYU,
somebody,
the new school,
on.
All around that neighborhood.
I mean, I'd love it to be the next pizza. I don't think that's, you know, who knows? Maybe that's a reality, or the next Chipotle or whatever. But
been busy?
Yeah, I mean, business is all right. It's a new business. You know, it's about brand development. We're hitting the numbers we feel like we need to be hitting to be functional. So, you know, at that point, it's just now it's getting the word out and getting the corporate clients in and getting customers to know we're there.
Well, you get the word out. So name of the name and the location again?
Uma Tamakeria. Okay. It's on the northwest corner of 14th and 7th.
Got to tell Ryan Sutton when he comes in. No, he's
we
not
do.
Gonna, so Eater's, has Eater been all over it? Eater jumped on it when you opened?
Yeah, they jumped on it when we opened. They gave us a nice
Are you
little,
part of the inside Eater clique? Because it's funny.
The infiltration is the key, and I've gotten in there.
You've gotten in there.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, Nick Solaris and I are very, very friendly.
Oh, Nick's a shit. He's
a good guy.
Just got promoted last year.
Yeah. Very, very friendly. So.
Okay. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Now, so tell me about your connection to Japanese food, and then let's talk about, we'll back it up a little bit. Tell me about Alonda, the concept, because it's Italian, but it's Japanese influence, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, well, everybody had that reaction at the beginning, and frankly, we're finally at the point where people are like, it's just good, we're going to come back again, because truthfully, it's just good. Like, this is not, and I was very happy when Pete Wells got it, because we were getting these like, oh, it's Japanese, this doesn't make any sense, and why? But no one actually nerded out about it and thought about how these two cuisines really work well together, and the roots of them are shockingly similar. They take fresh ingredients, quality ingredients, and they do very little to them in terms of manipulation to make them taste good.
Mm.
That's the root of both their cuisines.
Give you a point there. I can't speak authoritatively. I mean, I know Japanese cuisine, but just from the American point of view,
right.
Having not been to Japan, all my foodie friends have been to Japan. Like, dude, why haven't you been there? That place is off the hook. It could be the best food culture on the planet.
It's,
whatever. I don't do the best,
could,
but and I know the Japanese are fanatical about everything. Like when I got a couple black belts, and I know their style of karate. And how Samurai Sword is just a great example of they took something that everybody had and they turned it into like the baddest freaking sword on planet. Or I mean, so they're when they get into shit, they're big. And you're right about the cuisines. I've always thought that about Italian cuisine is you eat in Italy and it's so simple.
It's so simple, and it's so
it's
awesome.
Just ingredients.
It's just good ingredients
no
that
technique.
Are fresh. Nothing.
Just bing in a pan.
And I don't know if people can take this one way or another way, but I used to joke when I first got to Morimoto, like the Japanese technique is no technique. Like coming from 11 Madison Park for 4 years and Tabla for 3 years.
All technique.
It was all technique.
Yeah.
I got to Morimoto, and it was just like, yeah, you just put it in the pot and make sure it doesn't boil. And I'm like, really, dude? Like,
that's cooking?
Like, that's what you got? Like,
yeah, don't fuck it up.
Like, I'm done. What else you got? Like, I don't have 9 different knife cuts to put into this sauce. Like, all right, what else you got? So it was really, I used to joke about it, but when the more you do it and the more you pay attention to it, the more you sort of understand the simplicity and the beauty in that simplicity. And again, it's another tie into this Italian-Japanese. And you look at it, they're both almost entirely surrounded by water. Japan is. Italy is almost.
Yeah.
Coastal regions, food, mountainous regions in their northern areas. So you have this like braising and this low, slow cooking, and you have the noodles and you have the rice and all these things that are culatara and fish sauce and umami and the parmesan and the tomatoes and the mushrooms and all this is so naturally occurring umami flavors. It makes so much sense that these high umami ingredients in Japan work well together. We make parmesan dashi that is one of – it's our stock base for almost every one of our pastas in the restaurant. And it's traditionally made Japanese dashi with parmesan rinds in it. It's so tasty. It's like all you want to do is eat this stuff. And the little bit of fat that sort of clouds it up is from the parmesan. It just works, and it's hard to describe why it works, but it's not hard. I am describing
it. Come on. I'm buying it.
So it's really something that I was shocked by how few people took the time to understand it before they started judging us.
When did you get this idea in your head for that kind of a restaurant?
It sort of started coming together at Morimoto, because Morimoto always would be interested when
Which
I mentioned
before
something.
Before iFury.
Way before iFury.
Yeah, yeah.
Would always be interested in things when we'd start talking about menu and Iron Chef development, and because all of his sous chefs are involved in that. The filming happens in New York, so all the recipe testing happens in the restaurant. And he would always listen when you started talking about Italian food. He wouldn't listen about Indian or French, or which were all things I had many years of experience in. When you talk about tomatoes or mozzarella or olive oil or these sort of things, he'd be like, huh? And sort of listen and be like, yeah, we try. You know? And he would always do it, and it sort of sort of settled in that, like, he was always sort of interested in it and why. And then Michael was always passionate and always interested in eating sushi and raw fish. And you saw him then.
Excuse me, that's what I mentioned. I said, when they opened Marais, it's not there anymore, but when they first opened Marais, back left side behind the bar, was a crudo bar.
Absolutely.
Got rid of it for whatever reason. Concept didn't quite click, but it was, like, sushi, man.
It was sushi.
You sat down at that marble bar, and there were a couple of chefs behind there.
Sashimi is the right word.
Sashimi, correct. But, there was no rice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It was just raw fish being, you know, minimally handled with garnish.
And for whatever reason, they never took the made the decision to try and incorporate Japanese ingredients into it. They went like halfway, man. You know, they sort of like kind of got there and was like, yeah, but we're still Italian. And it sort of, for whatever reason, I mean, it's emotionally very difficult, and it takes a set of nuts to get out there and be like, yeah, I'm going to do something different. And you can either get it or not get it. It's emotionally really difficult.
Yeah, and financially, you got to have backers. I mean, yeah, who's going to throw down $4 million to say, oh, I really like your idea. Let's see if it works, Chris.
I mean, really, that's another big one. I'm very fortunate. And people can say whatever they want to say about my partners.
He's ugly.
Sure. Okay. If that's the only thing you got to say about him, he'll be very happy. Okay. But no, truthfully, they've been nothing but generous with me. They're supportive. They take care of me. They don't focus on the little details. They focus on the big picture and moving forward. And whatever their reputation is, I just will never understand it, because they are nothing but supportive and do nothing but allow me to do my job and to run the restaurant.
So we'll just pull the curtain open a little bit there. You listen to Food Talk, Michael Mecca, my guest Chris Jack, we're talking about Alanda. The main money guy is Jeffrey. Is
Jeffrey and his son, Zach Chatter.
Well, okay, so same family. And Jeffrey is a controversial guy in the city for a variety of reasons. I mean, we think of Drew Nieperant, and we kind of go, okay, legit. We think of Danny Meyer, we think, okay, legit. Mm-hmm. And then you start mentioning, like, Steve Hansen, and you kind of go, not so much. Right. So Jeffrey Chatter kind of falls in that category. On the other hand, mm-hmm. when you look at the numbers these guys do,
and you look at the track record.
Look at the track record of places that opened and don't close. I mean, these guys are doing between $250 and $350 million a year. Big. Like $250 million gross revenue in all their properties.
Because
there's stuff in Miami. There's stuff all over New York City. These are some of the biggest players on the planet.
On the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and Jeffrey just kind of sort of picked some fights and did some weird stuff.
Well, you know.
But whatever. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's,
enough.
He'll openly say
and
that
he's ugly and he's hairy.
Mistakes. But like, but again, he's just...
But he's got a sense for the damn business, dude.
He's passionate, man.
Hell yeah.
He really loves it. And people... that's the part I just didn't... I was shocked by as I spent 6 months talking to him. This wasn't like, oh, sweet, guys, let's go do this. This is going to be great. Like, 6 months meeting with him and his son, like, do we have the same ideals? Are we interested in this? And he's just... He's one of the most, you know, smart, passionate food people on the planet. He's eaten at every great restaurant in the world.
Right.
He loves it. He genuinely loves it. He doesn't do it because he has to do it. He does it because he really loves it.
He does. I mean, I think it was his first restaurant, New York China Grill.
Yeah.
That was
the
number one. And that, you know, at the time, that was pretty interesting shit.
Yeah.
I mean, it was uptown, that Black Rock building, mm-hmm. big space, open kitchen, I think, in the middle.
Yeah, I
remember because I was a chef in the city then, and I remember like going to China Grill and thinking, wow, this is like this weird Asian fusion mashup tasty shit. This isn't half bad.
Yeah.
I mean, has it aged well? Who cares? But I mean, he's and that was and now how many places does he have in the city now? I mean, we've lost count.
Yeah, it's a little, you know. Let's see, I can 10. I'd say is a
yeah.
Guess.
I was going to say close to a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and out of town. He's in Miami. He's all over.
Then there's ones that you would have no idea he's involved in, which is another beautiful thing about him. Like he doesn't, you know, regardless of whether or not he got it,
like
he
Red Farm.
Yeah, like Red Farm. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. See, I'm giving him his props. Tapped Eddie Schoenfeld. Eddie had Joe, the chef with him that he had at the...
Joe Eng,
who's great. And, you know, that place is...
Yeah.
Killing.
They're killing it.
Killing. With a concept to expand. Upper West Side, West Village. All right, so that's the... So that's interesting. So that's where that mashup came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's just... Those are my two go-to passion foods. Or noodles and rice are what my comforts are. And it was the opportunity... with a partner that believed in it to do something that was A, interesting, and B, something that I was truly passionate about. And they're the two things that I find the most interesting. And it was also an opportunity for me to sort of take a step back and say, what, as a chef, like, what am I going to do? Open another new American restaurant?
Right.
Open another French restaurant?
Right.
Like, what am I going to do? And
right. Where do you find unique space? It's local. We're foraging. It's new Scandinavian. It's Italian. I mean, it's been done.
Yeah, and I don't think there's really anything that's sort of even attempted, at least at the level that we've attempted here. As far as I know, there's lots of Italian restaurants in Japan. There's lots of Japanese restaurants in Japan. But there's very few people really sort of
putting
exploring the two at this level and sort of putting these things really truthfully together.
And I'm sure the wine list is great because initially you had Chris Cannon involved in the project as a consultant back when he was sort of in limbo pre what he's doing now. And Chris, you know, he's another guy. He's controversial. He's, you know, up. He's a smart son of a bitch. He can cook. He worked kitchenside. He graduated Brown, I think.
He did.
Yeah, I mean, he's smart. He can cook. Cooked in Paris in 2-star restaurants. And it comes to wine. He's just spot on. He was Michael White's partner for
a long time.
For the beginning of that meteoric rise until that whole shit fell down. But I could talk to him about wine forever. He's just like an encyclopedia.
Encyclopedic.
It's a great wine list.
It's a great wine list. And he really was integral putting that together. And we have a great beverage director now, Nathan Rawlinson, who I worked with at Love Madison Park. Who's doing a great job maintaining and continuing to push it forward. Eric Asimov has put several articles together about us having some of the best wine lists in New York and the Times. It's really been great, and it's really fun for the team, and we're reasonably priced. There's so many things I could talk about that wine list. I mean,
I'm coming in to eat. What's the address?
22 East 13th Street.
So just south of Union Square.
I mean, you're 1,000 feet from Union Square Green Market.
22 East. Is that the same block as Cork Buzz or a block?
It is, directly across the street.
Mm-hmm. Ah, see, that's crazy.
Yeah, it used to be City Tavern.
I know the space.
Borgo Antica.
Yeah. And I know Cora. I mean, Laura, she's talking about wine. She's...
Yeah, another one.
Laura's a beast.
I mean, Master Somme. How many women have their Master Somme licenses?
Pascaline Lapatier.
Yeah.
Yeah, she'll be on
that
the show next
it.
Week.
Yeah.
No, there's more. There's a few more. Actually, when you go back to the 90s, when they started to pop up, there was almost a woman a year for a while. It's brutal. Anyway, thanks for coming out.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Give a shout out. Name of the Alondas, 13th Street.
22 East 13th Street on Alonda, and Uma Tamakeria is 64 7th Avenue.
I'll hit them both.
Love
keep
to
up,
see
keep up the great work, New York Pro. Thanks. We're going to play some music for a minute, segue, and get my next guest, Chaz Brown, and talk about what he's doing on Clinton Street and all the shit that's going on Clinton Street right now in Manhattan. We'll be right back. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What are the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of Ports Up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hi, I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Where'd that guy get that voice? All right, we're live, boys. Hey, Mike Calameco here. You're listening to Mike Calameco's Food Talk. Get those microphones close. If you want to be heard, you got to get right on that thing. My next guest, Chas Brown, who I met, just opened up, maybe 4 months ago. So I live now in Lower East Side, on the Lower East Side. I'm on Grand Street down by the Williamsburg Bridge, south of Delancey, a couple of blocks. And my subway stop is Essex. Delancey, Essex, which puts me across Clinton Street when traffic allows. When you think of Clinton Street, you know, you think WD-50. Wiley was a pioneer 15 years ago down there. Unfortunately, WD-50 is shuttered as we speak.
Yeah.
As that whole strip is going to become like a 6-story apartment house for trustafarians of some sort. You know, million-dollar studios. That's the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But as I walk down Clinton, I'm noticing all this change going on. You got Black Crescent, you got Sushi Co. You're the proprietor of Soul Chicken.
That's right.
Leah Cohen is doing great things at Pig and Cow. Yunnan Kitchen down the street. Ivan Ramen. I mean, in that one block, well, not one block, it's 3 short blocks between Houston and Delancey, it's crazy what's going on.
And there's a lot more going on coming in, too.
A lot more coming in. And I've always felt that, like, psychologically, you know, as a New Yorker who's been here since 82, you kind of get to understand the anthropological development of the city, or the cultural anthropological development of the city, as it's expanded and borders became porous. I mean, you know, years ago, everybody, if you had the money, wanted to live on the Upper East Side. Now, nobody does anymore. Used to be that north of 72nd Street was dicey. 86, 96, that's all gone. Harlem has gentrified. Downtown is on fire, which is kind of a relatively new phenomenon.
Yep.
And the Lower East Side that was written off 15 years ago, it's like where everybody wants to be. But Clinton, to my point, is like that's like the furthest east you're going to go.
Yeah.
You're not going to be on Attorney. You're not going to be on Ridge. No. Clinton is the end. It's like the last line. And now it's like popping.
I love it down there. I mean, you know, we even have Azazu coming up. The guys from Speedy Romeo out of Brooklyn, they're opening up a new spot on Clinton Street as well.
That's where they're opening up.
Yeah. They're right there on, they're taking over Fatacucu, that space, and the ramen shop. So it's going to be a big St. Louis style pizzeria on that block. So, I mean, for me, it's great because I can walk out and just pick and choose of like a great meal for dinner. It's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go to Sushi Co. And everybody in the block's awesome. We do these things called boomerangs, as my business partner Rob can attest to. We pretty much send out something into the world. And maybe it's like a batch cocktail. We'll send it down to Sushi Co. So John Daly from Sushi Co. comes back one time with a whole cutting board with an omakase. Pretty much takes a cutting board all the way down into our restaurant, sets it on the bar, and is like, boomerang, bitch. So it was pretty badass. I mean, and that happens on the block all the time. I mean, everybody in the whole block is cool. From the guys from Black Crescent always giving me shit.
Yeah, no, I was funny. When we were filming there that day, you were in, it was just like one line. Unfortunately, it's PBS, and I can't roll tape on the best of the best, but it was just funny. Watching you guys play off each other was hysterical.
Oh, it's hilarious. They were closed for a private event last night, and all the guys from Vice were like, oh, what's a cool bar to go to? I'm like, oh, well, you guys should pop over to Black Crescent, but I didn't realize they were closed for a private event. So on the door, it says, we are closed for a private event from this time to this time. And yes, that fucking means you too, Chaz. So I was in the bottom of the thing. So I walk and I'm like, give me a fucking shot or I'm taking my clothes off in here.
And did they?
They gave me a shot.
So talk about Soul Chicken. Talk about your background. Let's get you. So you're from where originally?
I'm not really from anywhere if you really break it down. I was born in New Orleans. I was born in Lake Charles, Louisiana, but I moved around a lot. But I would say a big part of my heart is in New Jersey and Philadelphia. Okay. You and I have a little bit of that background as well, trying to make the trek up to New York afterwards. But did some time in Lebec Finn in Philadelphia, bounced around of all Steven Starr's restaurants throughout Philadelphia. But if you know anything about Philadelphia, Lebec was kind of...
It was it.
Yeah, it was our per se. It was our everything. It's no longer there. It's now Avance with the guys.
Yeah, George Perrier was the chef, and he was one of the friends. I mean, if you wanted to roll the tape back to like my era, you know, 70s, 80s, when I was an up-and-coming cook and then a chef, you had in New York, you guys like Jean-Jacques Rachou, Andre Saltner, Alan Sayak.
Yep.
Perrier in Philadelphia, what's his name? Jean Blanchet in Chicago. Yep. I mean, these were the guys you trained with. These were the named chefs in the country.
Yeah.
There was 10 or 12 of them. They were all French, and George was of that ilk.
Yeah, Chef Perrier was the guy that kind of whipped me into shape. I always, you know, always thought I was like, you know, hot shit and everything else. And then I got to that kitchen. It was like, I'm going to taste every fucking salad dressing that you make. And if I don't like it, I'm going to throw it at you.
Right. And they would.
My second day there, I must have served like a piece of oxidized foie gras. And I thought I cut it like nicely, but it wasn't up to his standards. So he takes the plate and he throws it at me and he misses and it hits the wall, breaks, falls into all my mise en place. He tells me to get the fuck out of his kitchen, the whole nine. And as I'm walking out the door, I'm like, I got fired on my second fucking day. And I'm walking out the back door and he said to me, he's like, and you better be here tomorrow early. And I was like, okay. I'm not fired. I'm just getting kicked out of the kitchen right now. Yeah, I was like, okay. And then I showed up the next day and I was just like smoking like four cigarettes, not knowing what to do at the back door. And then it was finally, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to walk in the door. And then he didn't say shit to me. He was like, literally, he yells and he gets it out and then it's over, which is the best part about him. He doesn't hold on to anything. That's why I think the man will live forever. If he's pissed, you're going to know. If he's happy, you're going to know.
He was a little, I remember the guy, I met him a bunch of times, a little short, sawed off French guy, full of energy. Yeah. Anyway, Lebec Fin was the anchor in New York City. It was the best restaurant from the day it opened till the day it closed.
Yeah.
Now Philadelphia is coming along with a kind of a robust restaurant scene compared to when I was there.
Yeah, it's changing a lot, you know.
And you might open in, I mean, there's rumors.
We're looking at a couple spaces in Philadelphia, and we're doing some other things down there, but we're definitely looking at some spots down there to open up another Soul Chicken. We're excited about that.
People listening to this might remember, Chaz, you were what season Top Chef?
I was on Top Chef season 9. I was the guy that fucked up the risotto.
There he is. Yeah. He did.
You know, I messed up the risotto, and trust me, and this guy sitting next to me, he constantly reminds me of it.
We don't have risotto on the menu. Talk to me about Soul Chicken. Talk to me about this concept. Because, I mean, you're a chef in Philadelphia, working in all these places, and you're doing something that one would think of would be more of like kind of bar food, in that it's an entire menu based on deep fried chicken wings and some vegetables that we'll talk about in a bit, too.
Yeah.
Why the concept, and when do you get the idea?
I guess it all started with Leah Cohen. I was helping her when she first opened up. And that's
another neighbor. Leah's across the street from
right
Pig and Cow.
Pig and Cow.
Philippine-inspired restaurant.
So we're over there. I was helping her when the restaurant first opened. And we used to party at this place called the Dumpa. And that's the 71 Clinton where we are now. And I kind of got to meet some of the people over there, the owner, everything else. And then there was a fire. And then it didn't really come back the way after, you know, after the fire. They lost a bathroom. They lost a lot of their guests. Just didn't really work out. So ended up talking to the owner one day, and she's like, well, what would you do in the space? And then, you know, my partner and I, we were talking, and then I said, well, you know, Pock Pock Wing couldn't even keep up with the demand of how many wings that they were selling.
Right around the corner.
It was right around the corner. So they had to change the fat tie to make sure that they could actually, you know, they could store noodles. They couldn't store enough chicken to keep up with the demand.
Right.
So I thought to myself, well, why don't we do wings? You know, the neighborhood loves it, and, you know, we can fry chicken pretty damn well. You know, we got a bunch of chefs that we're pretty sure we could fry some really good chicken. So our investor, being from Korea, And me being from the South, well, kind of from the South, I was born down there, we thought, why not do a mashup between the South and Korea when it comes to fried chicken?
Korean's known for its fried chicken, too.
Yeah. So it happened really quickly. I mean, the whole thing from start to finish, believe it or not, took about, what, 1 month? Maybe 40 days?
Oh, in the annals of New York restaurant, like, concept opening the doors, that's got to be close to the Guinness record.
I honestly believe that I don't know anyone that's opened up a restaurant for how much we opened it for and how fast we opened it up in New York City. Turning around, I mean, literally it was all my partners, this guy right here doing, I mean, he was putting up chicken wire on top of the walk-in and, you know, everybody was soldering and sweeping and drilling and everything else. I mean, literally guys that have never done anything like this before had to find something to do in order to make this thing happen. So we did it really fast, but, you know, we're really proud of the product. Everything about the restaurant is growing into something else, which is cool too.
Full bar, full liquor license.
Full bar, full liquor license, awesome cocktails.
About a dozen variations, and I'll tell you what, I mean, I read the menu trying to figure out, like, which one I wanted to try, and they all sounded good. Walk me down, just mention, like, three or four of them, because there is no, so you're not going to go there and just get a fried chicken wing, like, buffalo style.
Oh, no.
You're going to get, walk us through, like, three or four or five your best sellers. I mean, because these are great combinations.
I think our number one seller is the fish sauce and garlic. And if you go to a Korean restaurant, you're going to get the soy sauce and garlic flavor. And we thought, well, we don't want to do that because it's going to be kind of a run-of-the-mill thing. So why not do fish sauce and have a little bit of that umami in there? And it's people that are like, ew, fish sauce, I don't want anything fishy. And then they try it, and then that's their favorite wing. And I mean, and I'm talking about some brothers from across attorney that come across attorney looking for fish sauce and garlic. Now, oh man, you gotta have a fish sauce. That was Bobby Schmurder's favorite flavor. So that one's by far number one seller. People love it. It's got some garlic, it's got some sweetness, we got a little palm sugar in there, we got some roasted garlic, and obviously some really good fish sauce that we use in that too. So our sauces are probably the most expensive things in the restaurant. We don't skimp on those at all. Our number two seller is probably the gochujang buffalo.
So the Korean red pepper paste gochujang,
yeah.
Kind of a breakaway flavor now. Western palates are getting used to it. My wife's Korean, so I've been eating gochujang forever. I love it.
Yeah, it's funny part about it. People think that there's blue cheese on it because of the fermentation in it. Like, how do you guys get the blue cheese into the red sauce? I'm like, there's no blue cheese in there. So it's just the fermentation there. But it actually works well because we don't have to have cheese in the menu, which is expensive for like blue cheese. And you can actually get a little bit of that flavor in the sauce. And that's the only one that has butter in it. But it's probably our number two seller. It's got a little bit of heat, not too much. But it's a fantastic wing. I think it's like the one that's most, I guess, recognizable for someone that's looking out for buffalo wings.
And talk about the chicken, because you could have. I mean, I'm not going to mention who, but I've got some really good restaurant friends. I've got a bunch of great restaurants around town. And when they went to open up, they're known for fried chicken. They've had it on all their menus. When they went to open up a fried chicken place that just did their signature fried chicken, I asked them, like, so, you know, which farm are you using? Are you doing Amish? Are you doing free range? And they said, actually, we tested everything, and Tyson works the best for what we're doing. And I'm like, you're shitting me. Tyson? So hold on. So you're just doing wings. So they're doing thighs and drumsticks and breasts. I have no idea what they're up against. I respect these guys for whatever decision they made. I don't think it was just price point, I hope. But tell me about where your chicken wings come from, because it's neat.
So we don't subscribe to that nonsense at all. And I don't want to throw anybody on the bus, but to me that's ridiculous. To me, you're dealing with a 10-year-old chicken as far as I'm concerned. That's all old and, you know, just sinewy and gross. And not to mention, you open up one of those bags, like a 40-pound case of Tyson chicken wings.
Disgusting.
Literally, it's like faces of death. Like, you're putting your face in it like
an
ass.
Disgusting company, how they raise their shit. I mean, the whole
gross.
There's nothing about Tyson that's redeemable.
Like, that liquid on the bottom of the bag, hell to the no.
Yeah.
So we source ours from, we actually do with this guy, Della Pietras, on Atlantic Avenue. You know, some awesome guys out of Brooklyn, you know, old school Italian family, and they're fantastic. So what they do is, they pretty much try to find a price point for a wing that meets our standards. And sometimes our wings will be a little bit smaller, a little bit bigger, but they're never going to be like the gigantic ones just because we don't really deal with the older birds like that. And we deal with pretty much free-range organic chickens coming out of Pennsylvania. So he'll source us chicken wings every week because during the football season, the prices of the wings go up and down. They just keep going up and up and up.
Right, now through Super Bowl.
Do Super Bowl. I mean, it just goes insane. And you'll watch after the Super Bowl, they go way down because people are not doing as much. So what we do is we try to say, okay, give us a good price, but give us something organic, give me something free range. And he'll go out and he'll find the best he possibly can for us. And he goes out and sources this every week for us. So he'll actually get 10 cases of wings, 12 cases of wing for us, and then he'll hold them in his place, and we'll just go through there, or 20 cases of wings now, as we do a lot. And then even with our whole bird, same thing. He'll go out and source the best bird that he possibly can get for the price point that we want, as long as it's organic free-range birds.
And you had a neat idea with the breading, because, I mean, I've been making fried chicken forever. I'm from Philly, so yeah. Philly, big black town. When I was growing up in Philly, the only guys in kitchens were Italians, Irish, and blacks. That was pretty much a third. So I grew up, we all shared cultures together, shared neighborhoods together, basically shared cuisines. Tell me about, because you got an interesting, like, really light, crispy flour mix you're using, because it's a mix of what and what?
So right now we're using We're using rice flour, and we were trying to use potato starch. What else were we using, Rob?
Tapioca starch.
So what is it? We want to make sure that if you walked in the restaurant and you're sitting down with a girl, and she's like, "Oh, I'm gluten-free. I can't have any of that." It's like, "Oh, yes, you can. Yes, you can. I don't want to hear your excuse. Sit down and eat fried chicken and feel fat like the rest of us."
And to tell you about – I got a guest coming on in a couple of minutes. Ryan Sutton's out in the wings waiting. So I had all the wings are great. Yeah. All the wings are great. Place has a great vibe. Really mixed cultural crowd coming in too, which I love to see. And then you're like, you know, I come into wing place and I'm like, vegetables really, but I'm a healthy eater guy. So I'm like, all right, let me try. I saw somebody order it. Tell me about the cauliflower, because you have two vegetable things on the menu, cauliflower and one other, right?
Yeah, we have the cauliflower. We also have the. We have the kale and herb salad, which is just something that's just to like, hey,
fine,
don't die.
Fine. You know? So tell me about the cauliflower, because it was freaking delicious.
The cauliflower is probably our number two seller across the board.
Crazy good.
Almost everybody gets it. And the thing that we like about it is, you know, we wanted somebody that came in that was a vegetarian that wants to sit down and watch a game. We have all the games on.
Right. You got big screen TVs.
You know, big screen TV, Sunday ticket, you know, so and all that. So what we do is we have the guys come in and we said, we want these vegetarians to feel like as if they're eating something like a wing. So we kind of just broke the cauliflower up, we brined it, and then from there we made a dipping sauce, which is like roasted miso and goat yogurt. And
what's in that brine? Something's in that brine.
It's a turmeric-based brine,
and
it's funny because I've seen a couple wing places, I'm not going to name any names, that have now added cauliflower to their menu. Somebody actually brought this to my attention late last night when I was in the process of working on this hangover that I'm currently dealing with. And he said, "Yo, have you noticed that there's cauliflower at this wing spot now?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that." So which is great for us. I mean, imitation is a form of a compliment, correct? So we're excited about it. But, you know, cauliflower, you break it up, it almost eats like a wing.
It's delicious. No, it's great. I don't know why I was suspicious, but I'm like, you know, when you're in the wing, you're in that meaty, dumb guy beer mode. And then I'm cauliflower, I'm like, this is the best cauliflower I've had in a long time. Yeah. Kudos, man.
And there's a bunch of like Lower East Side awesome like clothing brands down there. So a lot of these guys, believe it or not, from these clothing brands are like the hippest, coolest guys, all the coolest clothes. Like a lot of them are vegetarians and pescatarians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these guys come in, you know, they're all dressed up fancy. They got their little entourage coming through. They sit down and watch the game. I'm not going to name any names, but they sit down and they're like, "Yo, let me get four orders of cauliflower." Because like everybody's getting 20 wings, and they're like, "Let me get four," because they want a big bowl of it, and they literally eat it like everybody else is eating their wings.
Good. It's good stuff. All right, give me the address. Soul Chicken, S-E-O-L-U. That's that spells right? Like South Korea.
Yeah, S-E-O-U-L.
S-E-O-U, whatever. You know, like Seoul, South Korea.
There you go.
I barely got out of high school. Clinton between...
Between Rivington and Stanton, we're on 71 Clinton. You can't miss us. We got about 8 feet of neon in the window.
8 feet of neon, and you're one of the few places that's open all day. You do lunch and dinner. It's nonstop.
We do lunch and dinner. We close a little bit for this beginning of this week. We had a couple of events we had to get done, and now you pop in. We have a new menu coming out, which is going to be dropping January 1st, like right for the new year. We're excited about. So you're going to see a lot more like seasonal changes in there. We're going to have a beef option, which is going to be some kind of bulgogi. I'm excited about the guys from Della Pietra's. They're actually going to dry age a ribeye for us. So I want to do like a chopped meat cheesesteak, but I want to do it with a dry age ribeye to get that funk flavor in there.
Dude,
so
I'll see you in January.
You got to give me the Philly guy love on the cheesesteak, or tell me it's shit. But at the same time, I'm excited where we're looking at getting our rolls from. So when you see those, I might be seeing more of you.
Good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jazz Brown, Soul Chicken's joint on Clinton Street. It's fantastic. Really low price point, really fun. Beer, TV, big screens, fun. Fun crowd to hang out with. Talk about hip-hop music. You never know who you're going to meet there.
Yeah. Shout out to Bobby Shmurda.
That's right.
A$AP Ferg.
A$AP Ferg was there. I was there, saw it with my own eyes. There you have
that's
it.
That's right.
Be well. We'll take a quick break and come back with Ryan Sutton, who is the one of several, but he's kind of like the gets all the big fish. He's the food critic for Eater at the moment. Was with Bloomberg for years. Do like a year-end roundup with Ryan of where he's been, what he loves, what he hates. Stay tuned for that.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Oh, that was cute. That was cute. A bunch of kids or something, like a kids' choir. All right, Ryan Sutton's back. Ryan Sutton has a great gig. He was with Bloomberg for a long time as their food critic of record. And now he's graduated Eater for many years that was not in that business is. They've got Robert Seitzma covering the ethnic scene in and around New York, something he's just amazingly good at, always was. But big fan of him since his many, many days at the Village Voice. And Ryan gets to go out and eat at all the fancy places with or without tablecloths, depending on how they want to do it these days. Great to have you. So it's been how long at Eater? A year? Less than a year?
Less than a year. I joined on April 1st. And
almost
so
a
I'm
year.
Getting there. Almost a year.
So, but you're hitting, anything new takes a little while. Not like this is a different gig for you. You're doing it at Bloomberg, but now you're getting a little bit longer. You're getting to play with bigger pieces, right? You know, bore down a little bit deeper. I kind of want to do like a year-end thing, which I know you're like, why didn't you tell me this before I just sat down, asshole? I don't have my notes with me. So I'm going to – I sympathize because I'm not in the same fish tank as you, but I'm eating out all the time. I'm filming – we just got done finally filming a show a week for the last like 3 months. And people ask me, so like, where'd you film last week? And I'm like, I don't remember. Like, how can you not remember? Because I don't remember. But – we know your worst restaurant of the year so far, I believe. I think the bottom was Tavern on the Green, those meals.
Tavern on the Green was not a good experience. But remember, that was under a different chef. That was under Katie Sparks.
Have
and, of course,
been back? Is Jeremiah in the kitchen now?
Jeremiah Stone, one of America's
Jeremiah
great
Towers.
Chefs. Jeremiah Tower, sorry.
No worries.
I got confused because I've been thinking about Contra, which is a lovely restaurant on the Lower East Side.
Thanks for saying that. I love that place.
One of my favorite restaurants of the year, Fabio Bonhausken and Jeremiah Stone are the chefs there.
Yeah.
They are at the opposite end, but back to Tavern on the Green. So Jeremiah Tower, he's the chef there. His menu won't be fully implemented until January, I believe.
Right.
And then I, alas, will have to go back to Tavern and subject myself to the food there, and hopefully it'll be a good subjugation.
Good luck. Good luck. He's I don't know what he's thinking. He's really pushing a rock up the wrong hill. But let's go down to Contra, because I discovered that place when it first opened. I knew some of the players from previous restaurants because, you know, I'm old enough now that I've been in New York long enough to watch these sort of young kids like skipping stones move from here to there. So I went twice last spring. At that point, it was a 5-course menu for a complete bargain, $55 a person, and the wine list was really, really good. Whoever the wine, so you, what's your takeaway? Tell me about that restaurant. Why you like it?
Well, first of all, I believe the restaurant is either almost a year or exactly a year old, and the price is still $55 for 5 courses. It's really a bargain, and what they're doing is they're kind of tipping their hat to the European Parisian Neo Bistro. They're tipping their hat to restaurants like Chateaubriand in Paris, where you go and you can get for about, I don't know, maybe €65, a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-course meal with the courses and all the bites that come with. You know, typically, both as Americans and as Europeans, or wherever you come in the world, wherever in the world you're from, you're used to having a kind of a no-choice experience, a longer tasting meal at the higher end, and kind of just like a bunch of a la carte dishes at the lower end. So what they're doing is they're bringing that neo-bistro style of dining into the lower price area. So instead of having to pay $195 for a tasting menu at Blanca, which is a great deal because it's one of New York's great restaurants, you can have a nice, not just delicious experience, but an ambitious experience at a very low price. price level, which is important because I believe it's not just the rich people, it's the everyday people who deserve to have something envelope pushing. That's what you get a contra. You have, you know, your popcorn mousse, you have your room temperature scallops, you have your roast chicken with a side of boudin noir, and it's not just like a regular boudin noir, which is like kind of, you know, tarragon-y and just kind of just soft. This is real irony boudin noir. It's like really funky. It's like a mixture of funk and the cleanliness of chicken. They're doing some really interesting, exciting things over there, and so I respect that.
And they might be doing, I shouldn't leak secrets, but I bump into the chef a lot. He shops at Essex Street Market. That's my neighborhood market. Gets his meat at Heritage, which is where I get my meat. And they're actually, they might announce pretty soon, we're at, besides the $55, they're going to do an a la carte, like spread out their wings a little bit. So give you a choice to order like smaller plates, appetizers, mix and match as you will.
And that would be cool too. And I've heard the same rumors. And we're all kind of, you know, biting our teeth and waiting for that to happen to see what else they can do with themselves. Talented young guys.
So 9 months in, What was your best meal this year?
Oh gosh, best meal of the year. That's like asking me to
your favorite song.
Oh, you know me. I don't kiss and tell like that. But I've had lots of great meals over the year. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about Marta lately. I hate to be a front runner.
Wow. Okay. You know, like Danny Meyer, the brand new Roman pizza place that I have not been to, and none of my previous guests have been to it yet either. And Chris Jackal was here earlier. And
talking about Marta can feel kind of like rooting for the New York Yankees.
Right.
You know, Ryan, you're on Heritage Radio. Why not pick one of the small guys like Contra or Barbell Knot? Why do we have to talk about Danny Meyer, you know,
right, who's guy that needs help, right?
The big elephant in the room who could buy up all the talent he wants. Well, you know what? Marta is a place I just want to eat every day of the week. I've been there twice since my review. Pardon me, three times. And it's a restaurant that just feeds you. It's Roman pizzeria. It's thin crust. And it really is a risk in that sense because restaurateurs who have tried to go off the Neapolitan path in New York have not traditionally succeeded. We remember Keith McNally's Pulino's tried to do a little bit of a non-Neapolitan thin crust. Didn't work. We remember Michael White at Nicoletta, which is still open, and I understand people still eat there, but it critically panned like few other restaurants have been panned. But now we have some guy trying to do the thin crust, and it reminds me of the pizzas I grew up eating on Long Island at Eddie's of New Hyde Park, I think. And super, super thin, but not cracker-like. They just have a little bit of a tug. And the ingredients and the execution is just absolutely perfect. You know, when we think of, you know, Roman cuisine, I think Pete Wells talked about this in his review of the restaurant. He talked about the holy trinity of cacio e pepe, amatriciana, and carbonara, and you get a lot of that at Marta, except on pizza form. There are no pastas there, but you get a carbonara pizza. It's loaded with potatoes and eggs and guanciale, and just the funk and the starch and the richness is just overwhelming at first, but your body just accepts it. It's absolutely amazing.
I have to go. All right, you got me going. Where have you been in Brooklyn this year that you liked?
You know,
that's a borough I don't get to go to a whole lot, which is crazy, because the F train's my train, and if I get on the other side of the platform, the side I don't use, I'm one stop. East Broadway, then I'm into the F stop border of Brooklyn, and like Carroll Street is like, I think, it's easier, faster for me to get to Carroll Street from where I live than like 14th Street almost.
And Carroll Gardens, of course, is one of the most beautiful areas of Brooklyn.
Yeah,
Carroll Gardens,
gorgeous.
South Brooklyn, the South Brooklyn waterfront. Haven't dined as much in Brooklyn this year as in previous years, but that said, I'll talk about two restaurants quickly. There's Dover, of course, by the Battersby folks, and man, just go to Dover on a Sunday night or a Saturday night in the summer and yeah. Their indoor space is really loud.
That sidewalk.
The execution can be so-so, but don't get the tasting menu. Sit outside in a summer night, watch the sunset in South Brooklyn, have a few expertly made cocktails, lobster, I believe it's cooked in butter, decent enough chicken for two, but it's just a really lovely experience sitting outside. For an even better experience, you go down to Pock Pock 2.0. Andy Ricker, who is, I believe, his original restaurant, is, of course, in Portland, Pock Pock, and it's an expression of northern and northeastern Thai fare. Really delicious. He came out here. Didn't really work in the first iteration. It was too small, the service wasn't very good, and it was too crowded. Moved into a bigger space, guess what? He's got a Michelin star right now. And his flavors are a lot more on point, and the people who are there seem really excited and happy to work there. It really does show the difference of working in a stripped-down space where customers can get kind of angry. I remember in the old Pock Pock, service was so bad, I actually had to go up and raid the wait station one time because I couldn't get utensils for what I was eating. And when they moved into the new space with, you know, with bigger digs, everything just became perfect. And they still serve one of New York's, I think, best gin and tonics. They infuse it with kaffir lime. And of course, when you drink gin and tonic, you just don't want to get boozed up and you just don't want to, you know, drink it for the refreshment. You drink it for something aromatic, at least guys who like aromatic gins like I do. So they infuse it with kaffir lime. And it's just an absolutely lovely way to spend an evening. Watching the sunset over southern Manhattan when you're on the South Brooklyn waterfront. Drinking a cold gin and tonic and eating a lop salad, you know, hand-minced pork with all sorts of pork offal and eating that with your hands. And it's a pretty just gastronomically lovely and visceral experience.
Yeah, and that's a little tiny bit of a hike. The nearest subway, you got to walk directly towards the water because there's nothing across the street. He is literally in that Brooklyn waterfront district, which I think actually has a name now.
Is it? Yeah, I used to call it Red Hook, even though it's not technically Red Hook.
No, but the bus runs to Red Hook down that street.
Correct. I think the South Brooklyn waterfront. You know, there's so many overlapping neighborhoods in that part. There's Borham Hill, Cobble Hill, and Carroll Gardens. I just call it all South Brooklyn, which I believe was the old historical name for the area anyway.
Places that you're looking forward to going to, what's on your radar coming up? Have you been to Via Carota yet?
I have not been to Via Carota. Robert Sietsema has. He lives in the area, and he likes it a lot. I can't wait to go, of course, by the people who did Jody Williams and her partner.
Right.
And Gusto. So we can't wait to go there. I can't wait to go there. I also can't, and I hate to be a front runner again, but you can't not think of 2015 and not think of Momofuku Ko 2.0. Yeah. We were talking about Pock Pock 1.0 just a minute ago, about how it was small, now it's larger, and how much more pleasurable the dining experience became. I wasn't a fan. I mean, listen, I gave them 3 stars when I reviewed Momofuku Ko for Bloomberg. And for me, it was really the restaurant that introduced me to the semi-affordable tasting menu. I remember back then when even Per Se was charging a lot back then, Momofuku Ko opened up and they charged, I think, $85 when they opened. Then they moved up to $100, and then they kept it at $125 for a few years. It's a little bit more expensive now. It's $175 right now, which puts it in the realm of most contemporary high-end tasting menu restaurants. Serves about 17 courses. And the question is, can they make that transition from being not quite a neo-bistro, but a small, affordable-ish tasting menu restaurant with cute little tiny, slightly uncomfortable digs to a modern tasting menu restaurant where people are spending a whole lot of money. $155 for the wine pairing, I believe. That's a lot of money. You know, add on tax and tip for two, and you're probably running in the ballpark of, you know, $800 or thereabouts if you're all doing the wine pairing. So can they make that transition from small and intimate to high scale and big bucks? I know a lot of people who have dined there so far, and they've all had very good experiences, but, you know, it's my opinion that counts, damn it. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see because it's playing at a different volume level all of a sudden. Yeah. I mean, doing 17, 18 covers is one thing. Doing the kind of volume they're approaching is a whole other story.
Of course.
Yeah, we'll see. But he's a pro. He's got good people behind him. I think, you know, it's one good thing with Chang is once you get so much momentum, you can get good people to come work for you because you've got a name. And that's one of the challenges I think chefs have today is getting good kitchen staff. Kitchen staff's a real crisis.
And getting backs on their seats, which then have a Momofuku Ko. So they have a tiny bit of
don't even talk about
lumbar
them.
Support.
Yeah, front of the house. That's a whole other world. Upper East, Upper West, what's going on in the city? Because those are neighborhoods that have really been asleep forever, and now there's some talent moving uptown.
There's a little bit of talent moving uptown. Not a whole lot. I wouldn't say either the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side is as much of a, pardon my use of this cliche, dining destination as much as anywhere south of, I won't even say 59th Street, as anywhere south of 34th Street.
You know,
you do a collection of venues that I've been reviewing, not just at Eater, but at Bloomberg, and the majority of them have been south of 34th Street. Yeah. And that's just, you know, that's where the kids are opening up. It doesn't mean you can't have, you know, great meals north of there. Barbaloo is still one of the, you get some of the best charcuterie in New York. What Jonathan Benno is doing at Lincoln seems to get better and better every year. Of course, Daniel Ballou at Boulousou is, you know, one of the city's better practitioners of Southern French cuisine. And I know that sounds boring, but there is just, you know, gosh, there's not enough exciting Southern French food in New York. You know, all the flavors of Provence, you know, the lavender and the tomatoes and the peppers. And actually bring it back to Dover for a minute. They're actually doing some very lovely Southern French cooking.
I want to give a shout out, by the way. Dover, it's funny. I hadn't we were filming in Brooklyn a while ago, and someone said, I want to meet we were at Chelsky's when he was on that street, and I wanted to introduce you to these guys at Battersby, and I went in, and these two young chefs back there in this little tiny kitchen didn't look great. They've done really well. Then they opened Dover, and I never went. And then 3 months ago, I had a meal at Dover that was great. And then I went to Battersby 2 weeks later. Same thing, man. I got to give those kids crop. They are good. They got chops. They're good.
I believe they're at least one of them. Both of them are not also. They've trained it under Alain Ducasse.
They were at Ducasse at the Essex House, then 11 Mad and Blue Hill. So great kitchens, great pedigree.
Guys know what they're doing.
They do. I'm gonna get. So that's my shout out for the week. We have to wrap this up. We're a minute late. Yeah, I was actually at Dover this week with that crew too. Really, Dover Battersby, great reason to take the F train to Brooklyn. I was impressed. One of the best meals I've had in Brooklyn ever. Ryan Sutton was back. We'll get him back in next year. You know, a couple of times a year, get him in the spring or late winter to talk about what he's been up to. You could read his work at Eater New York. Just look at Ryan Sutton. Follow him on Facebook, friend him on Twitter, whatever that shit is, you know. Just Ryan Sutton's his name. Ryan, thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Have a great winter.
Merry
Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah. We'll see you on the other side of 2015.
I'll see you on 2015.
Bingo. That's it for Food Talk. We'll be back next week, folks. Take care. Stay warm.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.